Today on the Bible Reading Challenge podcast, we are going to do an overview of the Gospel of Mark. And to help us do this, I have two guests joining me. We have Brian Marr, who is an editor at Canon Press. Brian, how you doing?
Great.
Good. We also have Dr. Tim Edwards, who is the academic dean at NSA here in Moscow. And Dr. Edwards, can you tell us what you were doing before you came to Russia?
Before I came to Russia, that threw me for a little bit there because I have been to Russia. I am not there now. I was living in Oxford in the UK. And I was actually working with a group called Bible Mesh, developing an online Hebrew program for them. But I've been in Oxford for 14 years. I did my doctorate there, and I taught there for 5 years.
Okay. So yeah, I think both Brian and I have taken Hebrew from you. And so if you come to Moscow, you want to come visit. If you want to go to New St. Andrews College, word on the street is that Dr. Edwards' Hebrew class is the most difficult class there. I remember the first term dreaming in Hebrew, not because I wanted to, but just because that's all that consumed me. So how has the attrition rate been in your Hebrew class this last year?
This last year, 100% survived.
Wow.
That it was a very small class to begin with.
Okay. Yeah, how many were in this?
Three.
Three, okay. I think when I was in there, that we had close to like 15 or 20 maybe, and there was...
So next year I already have 18 in the beginning Hebrew class. I think there'll be a couple more coming in.
Okay.
So that'll be more of a test.
Yeah, and if someone is just reading the Bible and they have some extra time on their hands, they're like, hey, I want to learn a language, is Bible Mesh something that you would point them to for a totally new beginner?
Yeah, Bible Mesh is both for Greek and for Hebrew.
Okay.
Is self-contained online class. You can sign up with the institute to do it with a tutor, or you can do it yourself. It's 2 years worth of Greek or Hebrew education, and you're in the biblical text every lesson, pretty much. So I would, they're great courses to take.
Yeah. I also just discovered recently this YouTube channel called Aleph with Beth. Are you familiar with this?
No.
So it's kind of a funny name, but there's this woman, I don't know if her real name is Beth, but she has these videos where they're teaching Hebrew, kind of like you would teach a little kid how to speak. So she's just holding like a picture of a horse, and she points at it and says, Seuss, Seuss. And I've been through maybe like 5 lessons or so, but it's really funny because we still haven't learned the alphabet yet, but you're just learning verbally how to, so I think it's teaching communicative biblical Hebrew. So I'm interested to see, we're living in this really fun time language-wise where it's easier to learn languages, and there's lots of different competing and even, I think, harmonizing ways of learning a language. So go on Google, look up Bible Mesh, and maybe look up Aleph with Beth if you're interested. All right, well, we didn't come here to talk about Hebrew, as fun as that would be. We came here to talk about the Gospel according to Mark. So Dr. Edwards, can you tell us, who was Mark?
Mark, according to tradition, was with Peter in Rome, and listening to him preach and teach and recall the life of Christ in the church in Rome. And then when Peter died, he put in writing the gospel in order to preserve that teaching. So that is, accepted by many sort of tradition behind who Mark is. Mm-hmm. There's a fun, and I don't know what, if there's any historical value to it at all. It's fun theology anyway, that Mark was a rich young ruler that came to Jesus and went away sad because he was a wealthy guy and didn't want to give up everything. But they also identify that rich young ruler as Mark, and as the man in the garden who runs away naked because he was afraid.
Yeah.
And so you have the rich young ruler who goes away disappointed, but in the end comes to Christ and loses even his clothes, you know?
Yeah.
Running away. So it's great theology. It's fun theology. I doubt the historicity of it.
But, okay. So let's just actually go there real quick. There is these two verses about just a young man who's naked, mm-hmm. I believe in the middle of the gospel, and then at the very end, you'd have the same language. What should we make of that little just kind of insert there? And you're wondering, like, what even, you know, if you're preaching, what do you even make of that passage?
You have to be careful what you make of it. Obviously, those traditions of that, it may be way, you can understand someone in the first century who is an anonymous, you know, there's no authorship given, so to speak, but the author inserts hints and clues. You could understand that it's a possibility, mm-hmm. but I don't think we have any certainty on it. And so when you're preaching it, you just have to be cautious.
Okay. And now we learn about Mark in other places mm-hmm. in the New Testament, that he's the cousin of Barnabas. I believe in Colossians 4:10 we find that out. And there was also this disagreement that Paul and Barnabas had about Mark. And it's kind of funny thinking, this is one of the guys who's, you know, I'm writing Bible. Paul's like, I'm writing Bible too, and I'm not taking you with me. What else can we make of this portrait of Mark, and how would that in any way help our reading of it or interpretation of what he's trying to do in this gospel?
I'm not sure how much it will help us in reading the gospel. I think it, when we have portrayals of people and the fact that there was disagreements and that there was a parting of the ways, although he became useful later, and all those things should serve us in preventing us to placing the writers of Scripture on pedestals that they themselves would not want to be placed upon. Mm-hmm. They were commissioned people to do a specific job. That doesn't make them saints in a non-Christian use of that term of saints, you know,
right.
Somewhat elevated and holier than the average person. We have to hold on to the fact that these were people not too dissimilar to us,
mm-hmm.
and that's who God uses. They have, you know, Peter and Paul had a, you know, clashed pretty heavily.
Yeah. You know, there's your papal infallibility for you.
Yeah, you know, and Paul and Mark had an issue, and I'd have loved to have seen Paul and James in a room together discussing the story of Abraham and justification. You know, mm-hmm. I think they would have agreed,
yeah.
but I think it would have been a pretty rousing discussion. That's what I would say.
So when we think about writing the way we have these four gospels, and we can only kind of speculate about who is using who. Mark is the shortest gospel. Some people would say because it's shortest, it was also the first one, you know, haste. There's all sorts of speculation about why it's short and what he's doing here. One of the words that comes up a lot in this gospel is this word immediately. Everything's happening immediately, and you're like, okay, what are you trying to tell me? What should people make of that kind of language and rapidity that seems to happen in this gospel?
Well, I think we have to take note of it, because, you know, to be a good reader of a text, to be a good listener to the what the author is intending and wanting us to hear, means paying close attention to the style, the repetition of words. And, you know, Mark has, you know, is famous for this. He just barrels through the stories. I mean, it's like, bang, let's go, 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 bang, 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 let's get through it. He's also famous for, in one sense, having a lack of, you know, the response of people to Jesus and the response of the disciples to Jesus is a little bit confused. You know, if you compare, for example, the Jesus walking on the water in Matthew and Mark, at the end of Matthew, when Jesus gets to the boat, they all worship him, and in Mark, they get into the boat, and they're all confused. You know, you have like, and that tells you somewhat of the difference.
Yeah.
You know, and what is it? And we have to listen to what Mark is doing, and he clearly wants to elicit a certain response, a certain reaction to the person of Christ whom he has portrayed, and he's using. Literary styles and his decisions about what he includes, what he doesn't include, to bring about that response. So we have to listen carefully, but and at the same time we have to realize that drawing conclusions on those sort of literary that literary style is precarious sometimes. You have to be careful because it's not always as clear as we'd like it to be.
Yeah. Brian, what advice would you give to people as they're approaching this gospel? Things that they should look for, themes that kind of develop here, maybe in distinction from a gospel like Matthew or John or Luke?
Yeah. One big thing I'll just begin with quickly is that usually a lot of conservative scholars at least tend to think this was written in the 60s. One reason that's given is that Jesus at the end in the all of that discourse, the prophecy of the destruction of the temple. Conservatives argue that it's very likely this was written in the 60s, AD, or earlier, not because it doesn't refer to some very notable events that actually did happen in the destruction of the temple, such as the big fire. So if it had been written after that moment, they would have referenced it, you would think, but they don't. And that's actually important for reading this gospel, I do think, because, you know, this is written to a particular people at a particular time. You know, in the 60s, you know, before that, the Jews had been persecuting the church pretty much from the beginning. And then in the 60s, the Emperor Nero had also started persecuting them pretty fiercely. And you can tell that, you know, Mark is very much writing this book for his original readers. It's, you know, Douglas Wilson says, the Bible is for us but not to us, and I think that's helpful, a wise way to read it. And then again, always looking carefully at the context and being ready for the Mark is famous for a few things. Irony is one that Dr. Edwards alluded to, where, you know, someone like Bartimaeus knows who Jesus is and the disciples are like, what's going on? And he's very concise. For example, there's one passage that I don't know what it means, where Jesus
just one?
Oh. But a famous one that I can't even make heads or tails of it, really. You know, the first time Jesus feeds 5,000, and then the second time he feeds 4,000, he says, how many baskets did you pick up from the first one? 7 baskets. How many did you pick from the second? 12. And I might have those numbers reversed. But he says, don't you understand? And I'm like, I don't know what's going on. Like, those numbers mean a lot to you, and they meant a lot to the original audience, but I don't know what they mean. So being ready for Mark's, you know, shortness and leaving a lot to implication. One big, big theme that I think explains the brevity of this book and the way it's written is that first Jesus, the way it sets it up, Jesus's first healing in this book, you know, he's baptized, he goes into the wilderness, there's a shortest account of his temptation by the devil, and then you have him going to a synagogue and he heals a demon-possessed man. And it's interesting because it puts Jesus' battle with the devil kind of at the forefront in the way that the other Gospels include that, but it's a little bit more front and center. And then he's telling them not to say who he is. And that's the famous liberal scholarship notices a long time ago, and conservatives have, you know, tweaked it, but it's been called the Markan secret, the idea that Jesus does not say who he is or doesn't let the demons say who he is. I owed this part to my good mentor, Peter Lighthart, at the beginning of the gospel, and I don't know if this is original to him, but he highlights this. At the beginning of the gospel, God declares that, you know, you are my son. Then the demons are saying it, and Jesus hushes them. And then in the middle, at the Mountain of Transfiguration, God says it again, right after Peter says that he's, not that Jesus is the Son of God, but that he's the Messiah. And Jesus says, you know, says, don't tell anyone about this, and there's this secrecy, which you do see in the other Gospels, but it's a little bit more emphatic in this Gospel. Jesus is the man of action. but doesn't want to be noticed for some reason. When the crowds want him, make him king, he goes off and prays. And at the end of the gospel, in typical, you know, irony on many levels, first Jesus is finally asked, "You are the Son of God." And he says yes, right when he's on trial, not the time that you would think would be the ideal time to do that. And then at the cross, the Roman centurion says, you know, this man was the Son of God. Another, again, irony, the Roman, the Gentile, gets it, and Jesus doesn't. And the disciples don't. And the point here, I believe, is that, you know, Jesus comes, and people expected the Messiah to be this, you know, warrior who would kick out the Romans. I mean, that's, I think everyone knows that. But I think it helped me a lot to realize that that's the expectation that he's subverting. He's not there to just give the Jews what they want. He's not there just to vindicate them. He's coming to save his people from their sins. He's attacking the Jews for their collective national sins. That, I think that's also been helpful for me to realize that, and that he is calling them to be ready to be persecuted instead of being ready to just win. And the whole point of not naming himself is, you know, he's not bringing glory to himself. He's giving glory to the Father, and he's showing the disciples how to do that. And he tells them who he is when he's suffering and he's, you know, about to be taken to the cross. So the gospel is trying to say, you see the Son of God truly when you see the cross, and that's what you imitate.
So I think we've talked in the previous conversations about John and Matthew. Beginnings are always important, and Mark dispenses with all birth narrative. You know, first 30 years is not there, but he starts straight away with two references from the Old Testament, from Malachi and from Isaiah. "Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you." That's Malachi. "And then the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight," which is Isaiah 40. So he sets up his gospel with these two Old Testament texts. Now, what's striking about those, Isaiah 40 is this, Isaiah is looking forward to the return from exile. Mm-hmm. You know, comfort ye my people, says your God, speak ye comfort to me to Jerusalem, famous King James, everyone knows through Handel's Messiah. It's a promise of consolation and a return from exile. So the highways in the wilderness in Isaiah 40, your first inclination is this: the highways on which the returning exiles will come back, the fulfillment of God's promise and the rebuilding of the temple. Malachi is a post-exilic prophet. He's in Jerusalem. And yet he says, using very similar language to Isaiah, "I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you." Mm-hmm. So the exile has happened, and yet Malachi is still saying there's more still to come. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it's not that the striking thing about the way that Mark uses this is the highways that Isaiah talks about, the way that Malachi is talking about, is not a way for Israel to walk. It's actually a way upon which God will walk. And so John comes, Mark says, and he's preparing that way through his preaching of the gospel of repentance. He's getting people to repent their sins. And that is the way. And then Jesus, who is God incarnate, comes and walks amongst them. So he's setting it up in this layered fulfillment of a return from exile. Mm-hmm. And actually saying, well, primarily the path is a path, it's a highway for the Lord to walk on, and Christ, therefore, is the Lord who is walking on it. So again, this, it's building on Old Testament hope, it's building on Old Testament promises. The return from exile was a fantastic fulfillment of God's promises, but it was left with, when you look at it, from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah through the time of Christ, Israel had about, you know, just a few decades of independence. The rest mm-hmm. of the time, they're under servitude. And so there was still this longing, there must be more, there must be more, there must be more. And so Mark is setting his gospel in that sense. And perhaps that's part of the reason why he keeps going, because it's that the fulfillment is now. The Lord is here. The highway is on, you know, the road is happening. Now we run down it. And then, the end of the gospel with the crucifixion, one of the striking things about Roman punishment often is a mockery of the claims or the sin or the crime that had been committed. And Jesus is being accused of being king, mm-hmm. and so what do? They set up this whole mockery of a king on his throne. You know, he's got a crown, he's got robes, they prostrate before him, and they stick him up on the cross with being the king of the Jews. And the way Mark writes it is that the mockery is turned on its head. Actually, it turns out to be, this is his coronation. Mm-hmm. It's just, you think you're mocking him as king, but actually he is being crowned as a king. And so the crucifixion has been set up in that sense as a coronation and a turning on its head of what the Romans were intending for it to be.
Yeah.
So you've got all these things happening in Mark's Gospel, and behind all of them, and lots of them are again Old Testament passages we've talked about before, and we just need to be having our ears open to those echoes.
Yeah. Last thing, there is debate over the ending of Mark's Gospel. Some have the resurrection account and kind of little Great Commission there about picking up snakes and, you know, drinking poison, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So you discussed this when we were in Gospel of John 8. Yeah. How do you take the long ending of Mark, as some people call it?
Clearly there's a lot of textual uncertainty about the last verses. I think there are three different endings to Mark within the various manuscript traditions. Mm-hmm. You know, 8, and then and halfway through, and then obviously all the way through to verse 20. So there's lots of textual uncertainty. Now, you've got to ask the question. Imagine the Gospel of Mark ending on, "So they went out quickly and fled from the tomb, for they trembled and were amazed, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid." Full stop. Okay? So this is the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, ends with them saying nothing and afraid. Now, there are people who are making literary cases saying, no, this makes perfect sense, because that's... you know, within the Eastern Church tradition, Mark is the great mystagogue. You know, there's mystery is the element of Mark's gospel, and he wants to inculcate mystery and awe into the readers. And maybe finishing on verse 8 like that or 9 might do that.
Yeah,
I feel I'm not. I just it seems.
It's a little postmodern for me.
It's a little bit postmodern for you. I wouldn't describe it as postmodern. I just think I'm not convinced that such a forthright beginning would end with such a sort of tame ending or such an unusual ending.
Yeah.
Having said that, the rest of it also doesn't quite fit with Mark's Gospel. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any easy solution to it. As I said, with in John's Gospel and the woman caught in adultery, I'd read it, I'd preach it. Mm-hmm. If I was given a Bible without it on, I would, and asked to preach on the last eight verses of Mark's Gospel with finishing there, I would do it.
So we should read it at least.
Yeah, read it. Read it. I think there's a human frailty which we can, and you see it within, I think, the history of church. We can often build our tallest towers on the most uncertain of foundations. Mm-hmm. So you just have to be careful. And that's where the revival of the original languages from the Reformation on. Yeah, it was so important. You know, Luther said the gospel will not survive long without the languages. Mm-hmm. And it's not that everyone has to learn the languages. You can read the Bible and you're reading the words of God. When you read it in English, when you read it in Bakwe, when you read it in French, you're reading the words of God. Read it, trust it. I'm all for that. I would always encourage people to read in lots of different versions and compare. Now, if all four or five English versions have the same translation, essentially, then you'll know that but if you have different versions, some don't include the verse, some do, you go, okay, first thing, there's some manuscript issues here. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to proceed a little bit more cautiously. Then you look at each translation, and they're all wildly different. You go, well, not only are there textual problems, there are also language problems. It's difficult text to understand. And then, you know, proceed a little bit more cautiously. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a good rule of thumb. It's not to say I'm not going to read it, I'm not going to take it as the word of God, but you don't want to build your tower too high. You build your life based on an interpretation of a verse that, you know, in the last 2,000 years people have struggled to understand.
Yeah. So we'll conclude by encouraging you not to drink poison or pick up any snakes just to find out if this text is inspired. Brian, Dr. Edwards, thanks for joining us. And if you have questions about the Gospel of Mark or any of the Gospels, please comment on in one of the Facebook groups, and we will look at those questions. And if they're good questions, we may try to answer them. Until next time, keep on reading.